नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Om. Reading today from Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 6, text number 31 and 32. Sarva bhutastitam yomam bhajatye katvam astitah sarvatha vartamanopi sayogi mai vartate. Such a yogi who engages in the worshipful service of the Supersoul, knowing that I and the Supersoul are one, remains always in me in all circumstances. Purport. A yogi who is practicing meditation on the Supersoul sees within himself the plenary portion of Krishna as Vishnu, with four hands holding conch shell, wheel, club, and lotus flower. The yogi should know that Vishnu is not different from Krishna. Krishna in this form of Supersoul is situated in everyone's heart. Furthermore, there is no difference between the innumerable Supersouls present in the innumerable hearts of living entities, nor is there a difference between a Krishna-conscious person always engaged in the transcendental loving service of Krishna and a perfect yogi engaged in meditation on the Supersoul. The yogi in Krishna consciousness, even though he may be engaged in various activities while in material existence, remains always situated in Krishna. This is confirmed in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1-187 of Srila Rupa Goswami. Nikilasvapi avastasu jivan mukta sa uchyate. A devotee of the Lord, always acting in Krishna consciousness, is automatically liberated. In the Narada Pancharatra, this is confirmed in this way. Dikkaladyana vachinne krishna cheto vidhaya cha tanmayo bhavati kshipram jivo brahmaniyo jayat. By concentrating one's attention on the transcendental form of Krishna, who is all-pervading and beyond time and space, one becomes absorbed in thinking of Krishna and then attains the happy state of transcendental association with him. Krishna consciousness is the highest stage of trance in yoga practice. This very understanding that Krishna is present as Paramatma in everyone's heart makes the yogi faultless. The Vedas, Gopala Tapani Upanishad 1:21, confirm this inconceivable potency of the Lord as follows. Ekopi san bahudha yo vabhati. Although the Lord is one, he is present in innumerable hearts as many. Similarly, in the Smriti Shastra, it is said, Eka eva paro Vishnu sarva vyapina samshayaha aishvarya rupam ekam cha surya vadbahudheyate. Vishnu is one, and yet he is certainly all-pervading. By his inconceivable potency, in spite of his one form, he is present everywhere, as the sun appears in many places at once. We'll read the next purport, text number 32. Translation. He is a perfect yogi who, by comparison to his own self, sees the true equality of all beings in both their happiness and their distress, O Arjun. Purport. One who is Krishna conscious is a perfect yogi. He is aware of everyone's happiness and distress by dint of his own personal experience. The cause of the distress of a living entity is forgetfulness of his relationship with God. And the cause of happiness is knowing Krishna to be the supreme enjoyer of all the activities of the human being, the supreme proprietor of all lands and planets, and the sincerest friend of all living entities. The perfect yogi knows that the living being who is conditioned by the modes of material nature is subjected to the threefold material miseries due to forgetfulness of his relationship with Krishna. And because one in Krishna consciousness is happy, he tries to distribute the knowledge of Krishna everywhere. Since the perfect yogi tries to broadcast the importance of becoming Krishna conscious, he is the best philanthropist in the world, and he is the dearest servitor of the Lord. Nacha tasman manusheshu kaschin me priya krittamaha. Bhagavad Gita 18:69. In other words, a devotee of the Lord always looks to the welfare of all living entities, and in this way, he is factually the friend of everyone. He is the best yogi because he does not desire perfection in yoga for his own personal benefit, but tries for others also. He does not envy his fellow living entities. Here is a contrast between a pure devotee of the Lord and a yogi interested only in his personal elevation. The yogi who has withdrawn to a secluded place in order to meditate perfectly may not be as perfect as a devotee who is trying his best to turn every man toward Krishna consciousness. So let me begin by offering my obeisances to all the assembled Vaishnavas and begging their blessings to speak something on these very enlightening verses today. The subtitle of these verses could be summarized as the perfection of the yoga process. By this time in the sixth chapter, Krishna has fully described the symptoms of a perfected yogi. Everything that can be hoped and aspired for on the process from karma to jnana to dhyana has now been achieved, and it's symptomized by what? This equanimity, or this equal vision towards all living entities, that he sees everyone, whether they're suffering or enjoying, like his very own self. So we'll recap a little, describe what is the process of yoga which has been followed to come to this point, and we'll describe the relative virtues or merits of the path of bhakti versus the path of Ashtanga yoga in and of itself. And we'll attempt to demonstrate that, as Prabhupada is explaining here, one need not perform this intense tapasya to control one's senses if one can simply remember Krishna and perform devotional service to Krishna. So the austerity involved with the yoga process can be illustrated by this one story which took place in a village long ago of a woodcutter who is going out to perform his duty of chopping some wood in the forest, passing through a massive forest. But it was a new forest, and his friend warned him before he went into the forest. He said, "Be careful, my friend. The forest is full of wild animals. Therefore, you should equip yourself with a sharp weapon to protect yourself against an attack from a wild beast." But the woodcutter thought nothing of this advice. He failed to pay heed, and he said, "What do I need of a weapon on me when I go to the forest? Everywhere, on every tree, is a weapon, a stout, sturdy branch I can just pull down, and I can use this branch to chase away the wild animals. I don't need to carry anything with me." And sure enough, in order to test his boast, as the woodcutter entered the forest, very soon he was pursued by a man-eating tiger. The man-eating tiger darted out in front of his path and began chasing after our woodcutter. In response, in a panic, the woodcutter, he dove to grab a branch from the tree, and with his saw, he attempted to saw down the branch from the tree. But he was too late. The man-eating tiger was already on him and had clamped down on his neck, started eating him and tearing him limb from limb. Our woodcutter had no chance to protect himself against this beast. So in the same way, our proud woodcutter is similar to the process assumed by the Ashtanga yogi, one who attempts to enter a secluded place and by the strength of his own personal endeavor to control his senses and to free himself from the influences of lust, greed, anger, pride, delusion, and so forth. Why? Because at any moment, this yogi who is attempting to meditate on his own can be victimized by the man-eating tiger of lust, of greed, of anger. At any moment, these anarthas can surface in his heart and spoil his whole meditation. This is illustrated by the pastime of Durvasa Muni and Ambarish Maharaj, when Durvasa Muni, upon discovering the vrata, the austerity of Ambarish Maharaj, became so inflamed by anger He's so infuriated that he cursed Ambarish Maharaj on the spot. So why should a yogi, who's austere like our Durvasa, actually have a need to resort to this cursing, to feel this anger arise in his heart? But the problem is, Durvasa Muni was not actually in control of his senses. He let his anger get a hold of him. So therefore, we can see that throughout the Puranas and the epic stories, time after time, the yogis are falling victim to either their lust or their anger or their envy, and actually not displaying the symptoms of a real advanced transcendentalist. Another flaw with the yoga process is that its aims are somewhat misguided and are very much apt to being misdirected. Once, in a village a long time ago, a yogi entered the village from the horizon, and all the villagers went to greet him. It was one of the villagers who had been living there 10 years ago, but had decided to dedicate the last decade of his life towards the process of penance up in the mountains. And now, after long, arduous austerity, he had come down from the hills and rejoined the society. And all the villagers crowded around him to inquire of him of what kind of powers and what kind of achievements he had made off on his own. And so this yogi explained that he had developed many mystic powers and would be willing to give a demonstration to the villagers. So the villagers said, "Oh, what can you do?" And our yogi proudly boasted, "I can walk on water. Just see, let's go to the river." And so the whole village accompanied this yogi to the river to see this display of mystic power. And all at once, an old man emerged from the crowd, and he approached this yogi, and he said, "So, you can walk on water?" And the yogi said, "Yes." And the old man said, "You know how much this power is worth?" And the yogi said, "No, how much?" And the old man said, "About 2 paisa. And the yogi, in anger, demanded, "How dare you belittle my mystic perfections? 2 paisa? This is 10 years of tapasya. This is the fruit of so much control and amazing austerity." And the old man said, "2 paisa, why? Because I pay the boatman over here, and he takes me across the river for 2 paisa. I don't need to walk. I just pay a man, and he takes me. What is the use of all this power that you've acquired?" So we see that even after so much effort, what is the real gain to be derived from all this austerity? The real fruit of our devotional service, or any of our tapasya, should be, as Krishna is explaining in this verse, this vision of seeing every living entity in connection with the Lord by seeing the Paramatma in everyone's heart. It doesn't matter what mystic powers you achieve. Once a man approached Srila Prabhupada and told Srila Prabhupada, he asked him, "Oh, you're no transcendentalist. My guru is a great mystic yogi." And Prabhupada asked him, "So what can he do?" And this man said, "He can levitate. He can fly. Can you fly?" And Prabhupada asked him, "Even the cockroaches can fly. What is the use of all this activity?" So we see that there's no real benefit to this material manipulation of one's senses and pranayama and gaining all these perfections when really that's not the goal of the whole process. What is the goal of the process? Well, Krishna is explaining in this verse, it's to develop this equal vision, to ascend to the platform of knowledge by which we can actually detect that all living entities are part of God. This point has been made earlier in the Gita, in the 4th chapter, when Krishna explains, "Yad yatva napunar moham evam yasyasi parnava yena bhutanya sheshani drakshasyatmanyathomai." That the fruit of having approached a self-realized soul and inquired submissively from him, the knowledge that is to be gained by the association of a bona fide spiritual master is what? It's the realization or the vision that all living entities are part and parcel of me, that they belong to me, and that they reside within me. So this is the knowledge that we're trying to attain, and one need not torture one's body in order to achieve this platform of vision. All one needs to do is adjust one's consciousness, and this can be achieved right now. All one needs to do is submissively follow the instructions of Krishna and act with this state of mind. So the power of intelligence can be described by a story of a man who went on a hunting expedition in the African savanna. But he decided not to go on a hunting expedition alone, but he decided to bring his pet hunting dog with him. And so along this hunter went in full regalia out into the forest, out into the plains, and he was pursuing wild game. But as he was chasing after these wild animals, his dog ended up running off into the distance and became separated from his master. And this dog, with all his might, couldn't find his master. He was stranded all by himself out in the wilderness. And so this dog became very frightened, and as the sun was setting, he detected that he was actually being pursued out in the wild by none other than a leopard. The leopard was following his tracks and was about to make a meal of our hunting dog. And so as the dog could detect the leopard crouching in a bush behind him, ready to pounce, the dog became so frightened, but he had an idea. And in the corner of his eye, he spotted a pile of old bones. And so our dog decided to jump on the pile of bones and pretend to be snacking on the bones. And he decided to lick his lips. And right as the leopard was about to pounce on our dog, he overheard the dog exclaim, "That was one tasty leopard. I hope there's some more of these leopards out in the woods for me to satisfy my tongue with." And so the leopard stopped dead in his tracks out of fear. He said, "This is no ordinary dog. I'm glad I didn't risk my life attacking this man-eating dog. He would have made mincemeat out of me." So our leopard backs off and walks away, and the dog considers himself victorious. But just at that moment, the dog spies out of his eye. He sees a monkey who is up in the tree, and the monkey had witnessed the whole scene. He had seen the whole thing unfold from the beginning, and the dog was very wary of the monkey. He says, "These sneaky monkeys, they have some kinds of plots he's trying to hatch." And sure enough, what was the monkey thinking to himself? The monkey knows that according to the laws of the jungle, he also is food for the leopard. And so he decided he wanted to cut a deal with the leopard in order to protect his own skin from being devoured by the leopard in the future. He decided to expose the dog's cunning. And so he chased after the leopard and he said, "Stop. Oh, big cat of the jungle, you're the king and I want to appease you." And he started explaining the dog's tactics. He said that actually he was just fooling you and you fell for his trap. And the leopard became so insulted by this act of cunning that the leopard became infuriated. And he said, "I'm going back there to teach this dog a good lesson." And he told the monkey, "You jump on my back and we'll go over there, back where the dog is sitting." And so in the meantime, the dog is sitting there and he immediately detects that the leopard is back and he sees something fishy going on. And so the dog, he can't decide what to do. And then he gets another idea. Our clever dog thinks to himself, and then all of a sudden he exclaims again so he can be overheard. He says, "Where is that monkey? Those monkeys can't be trusted. I sent him off half an hour ago to look for a new leopard for me to eat, and he still hasn't come back. Where is he?" And so our leopard again backs off and thinks that the monkey's trying to fool him again. And so our dog again emerges the victor in this play, in this contest of will, in this tactics of the intelligence, in the intrigue. So what we can gain from this is that even though the living entity may be greatly outmatched by the power of Maya Devi, that the temptation to satisfy our senses, to gratify our desire for material enjoyment is so great. And we are just like puny, puny little atoms in comparison to this ferocious leopard of Maya Devi, that she has so much power to overcome our senses and to keep us fixed in bondage. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagavan Ki Jai. Yet in spite of this, if the living entity is unintimidated by the stunning, insurmountable odds of going up against Maya Devi, if the living entity takes shelter of the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, of the wisdom imparted in these pages, then the living entity can outwit Maya Devi coming after us. And how does this take place? Because our bhakti yogi, who is fixed in this transcendental knowledge, actually gets Krishna on his own side. Rather than having to face off against the leopard single-handedly, one gets the assistance of the Lord. As Krishna says, Daivihesha gunamayi mama maya duratyaya mameva ye prapadyante mayametam tarantite. That this ocean of material nescience is impossible to overcome, but one who simply submits to me, surrenders unto me, for him and for him only, there is a chance of crossing this ocean. And so in the same way, by surrender to Krishna, we can have some hope of controlling our senses, and with this control of the senses comes the gradual development of knowledge within the heart of the living entity. Because Krishna promises that even though you may not be so advanced in your sense control, in your renunciation, nonetheless, if one simply is engaged in serving me undividedly with love, then I reveal in this entity's heart all the knowledge he needs to come back to me. Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. So this is the power of this transcendental knowledge. And how is this knowledge exemplified? And what makes our bhakti yogi superior to, for example, the Ashtanga yogi who denies Krishna's position or who is simply ignorant of the personal aspect of the Lord? This is exemplified by the story of Narada Muni. One time was wandering along his travels and he chanced to cross upon a brahmana who was performing his prescribed duties. And upon espying Narada Muni, the brahmana inquired. He said, "Oh, Narada Dev, where are you headed?" And Narada Muni explained that he was heading to Vaikuntha to visit Lord Narayan. And the brahmana said, "Oh, will you please ask on my behalf, our Lord Narayan, that when can I expect my salvation? How much longer do I have to wait? I'm very eager to know." And Narada Muni assured him, he said, "Definitely I'll ask for you when I get there." So Narada Muni continued along his path, and Narada Muni came upon a simple cobbler mending shoes in a shop. And this cobbler also became aware of Narada Muni's destination and had the same inquiry. He wanted to know when he could expect his own salvation. And Narada Muni also assured him, "Yes, I will put your appeal before Lord Narayan when I get there." And in due course of time, Narada Muni is right before his Lord Narayan. And he asks these two questions. He says, "Of course, Narayan, you're all-knowing. You must be knowing that I have two questions to ask you. So, what is the fate of our brahmana?" And our Vishnu thought about this and he said, "For him, it's very uncertain. He's definitely not coming back to me in this lifetime. He's going to have to wait several lifetimes before he has any chance of coming back here." And Narada Muni asked, "And the cobbler?" And Vishnu replied that this cobbler, at the end of this life, will attain all perfection and come back to me without a doubt. And Narada Muni, taking note, returned to this planet and upon meeting this brahmana, informed him of the news. And the brahmana was appalled. He was shocked. He said, "Why on earth am I not worthy of going back to the supreme kingdom of the Lord? I am so fixed in my duties, in the mode of goodness, in performing all my religious duties. I'm following the Vedas to a T. This is clearly unfair. And Narada Muni, he decided to perform a test to discern the real quality of this Brahmana's faith. And he said, well, let me ask you. Out of curiosity, would you like to know what Lord Narayan was doing when I met him in Vaikuntha? And the Brahmana said, what was he doing? And Narada explains that, he was sitting down and he was trying to push an elephant through the eye of a needle. And this Brahmana, he said, an elephant through the eye of a needle? This is preposterous. You're making up some tales. This is impossible. And Narada Muni just shook his head and continued along. And he met the cobbler, and he informed the cobbler of his good fortune. And the cobbler was also posed this question. He said, do you know what Narayan was doing when I visited him? And he said, no. Narada informed him that he was attempting to put an elephant through the eye of a needle like that. And the cobbler said, wow, Lord Narayan can do anything, can't he? And Narada said, what? You believe this? Just offhand? You accept? And the cobbler, who happened to be sitting underneath a banyan tree at the time, said, of course, why not? My Lord Narayan is all-powerful. Take this seed, for example. Within this seed is an entire banyan tree. Given some time, given some water, and it can grow into its massive size. It can grow exponentially. And so, for Lord Narayan to take a massive elephant and to shrink him down to the size of an eye of a needle, it's just the reverse process. It's not so inconceivable. My God is Bhagavan. He can do anything. And Narada Muni nodded his head approvingly and decided to spread this story to all living entities in order to demonstrate the power of one's faith in the Lord. When one is riddled by all kinds of doubts, this directly hampers our potential or our ability to actually return to the God's kingdom, because these doubts interfere with the flowering or the cultivation of one's devotional creeper, that so long as one is lacking in this humility and this faith and surrender, one can never actually cleanse one's heart of all these anartas and become sufficiently purified to actually become fixed in loving service to the Lord. So herein lies the secret, is having this faith in the Lord, this faith and knowledge that Krishna is three things. Prabhupada is saying, all you need to do to advance in devotional service is become convinced of these three facts given in the fifth chapter. He explains, bhoktaram yanyatapasam sarva loka maheshwaram suridam sarva bhutanam yatvamam shantim richati. The one who knows the Lord as the supreme proprietor of all the worlds and all the demigods, one who knows the Lord as the enjoyer of all the activities of man, and thirdly, one who knows the Lord as the supreme friend of all living entities, he attains perfect peace without a doubt, and from that peaceful state attains to the topmost platform of happiness. So the point that's being made by Krishna in this sixth chapter is that we should be concerned about the end of the yoga process. What is the ultimate goal of the yogi? And this is knowledge and action in knowledge. One need not sit on his kusha grass mat on the secluded place by a river alone, renouncing his family, renouncing his connections, renouncing his job, his children. This is not required for the aspiring devotee, so long as, provided that, the devotee simply acts with this knowledge of these three things. And this is sufficient. So Krishna is explaining how easy this process is. It's not an arduous task. You need not have the flexibility of a yogi or the amazing superhuman renunciation. One simply needs a clean, purified heart and this devotion and service to the Lord. So this is the secret, is just this knowledge. And anybody is qualified to act with this knowledge. power of knowledge is also demonstrated in our story of one man was driving one day, and all of a sudden his car engine started sputtering, and his car was stranded in the middle of the street. So he was naturally searching for a repair shop, a mechanic, to fix his car, and so this man pushes his car all the way to the nearest shop. And so upon pushing his car into the garage, the mechanic takes a look at the car and he's saying, engine problems? And our driver says, yeah, can you do anything about it? And our mechanic, he pops open the hood, he looks around and he says, yeah, I can definitely do something about this, but it'll cost you 1,000 rupees. And so the man, he's got to get back to work, he says, sure, 1,000 rupees, go ahead. How long will it take? And the mechanic said, just wait, no problem. So the mechanic pulls out his box of tools, pulls out a hammer, starts scanning the engine, and he finds one little screw fixed in one corner of the engine. And he looks at the driver, smiles, and he, wham! He just smacks the engine in that one place, and immediately the engine starts to resume. It's working perfectly again. And so mechanic's dusting his hands off, satisfied with the job well done. And our driver demands, 1,000 rupees for that? Are you a crazy cheat? How dare you inflate the price? All you did was strike a hammer to your engine. How is that fair? And so in the meantime, the mechanic's drawing up the invoice, and he says, banging engine, 990 rupees. Knowing where to bang, 10 rupees. Sorry, other way around. Banging the engine, so easy. Anybody can do it at any monkey can hit an engine. But the special virtue of the mechanic is the knowledge, his experience in actually knowing which screw to hit at what time like that. So this is the power of transcendental knowledge, is that if this driver was qualified enough to know where to hit, then he could have saved himself all this money. But instead, he's ignorant, so he doesn't know where to hit. The process is so easy. Krishna consciousness means chanting, dancing, and feasting. One need not try to have darshan of the Paramatma, Vishnu, within his heart. Screw his brain to control his senses, to exclude all the disturbances of the material world. One can simply take darshan of Krishna in the temple. You simply use your legs to walk to our Radha Gopinath Mandir every night. How difficult is that? The process is so easy. You need not go to a secluded place, provided that you simply have attraction for the Lord in his form of the deity, for the Lord's devotees, for hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, for living in a holy place, for associating with sadhus. This is all that is required for our advancement in devotional service, not some bodily gymnastics as Srila Prabhupada explains. So this knowledge is what's so powerful, and this is really the culmination of our yogi in the sixth chapter. So at this point we ask, then, how is it that one can actively engage in service in this knowledge? And again, we hearken back to our verse in the fifth chapter, which talks about this notion of proprietorship, is that to see the world in knowledge that this family of mine is not my possession, it's actually Krishna's possession. This house of mine is actually Krishna's house. And all the living entities belong to Krishna. They're his possession. And one needs to act with this consciousness. Otherwise, one gets entangled into deluding oneself into thinking that one is the Lord of material nature, that anything, one of these things can be my rightful possession. And so if we attempt to trace many of the social, political, economic problems in the world today, it's very much connecting back to this point of proprietorship. Prabhupada gives his peace formula in this verse in the fifth chapter. He says, by understanding the proprietorship of the Lord, peace can be attained in the world. And why is that? Because all the resources of this planet, which are actually growing in abundance, can be distributed for everyone's welfare. Lacking this vision of God's proprietorship, Ishavasyamidam sarvam, yatkincha jagatyam jagat, lacking this, one becomes deluded into thinking that one can possess anything. And so to take this example to an extreme, we have our billionaires who dot the world over. It's said in The Planet today that 1% of the global population, 1% of the 6 billion people on the planet, possess over 40% of the world's resources. That because of our legal system, you can actually claim to own something and to exclude people from the use of that real estate or those resources like that. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, we find that 50% of the world population, about 3.5 billion people, can only call to their name approximately 1% of the world's resources. So we have this amazing imbalance in property. And on the one end of the spectrum, we look at the insane wealth that some of these billionaires have. And I was reading the other day that there's one very famous oil tycoon, he's a billionaire, who lives in Russia again. And of course, he's got his million-dollar mansion, he's got his yacht, he's got his sports cars. But the problem is, you have to compete against all the other fellow billionaires who also have a yacht, a mansion here and there, and all the sports cars. So in order to achieve some distinction from the pack, one inevitably looks skyward to see what else can I grasp under my control. And it's said that this same billionaire, he actually, out of absent-mindedness, forgot his wife's anniversary. And in order to repent for this forgetfulness, to make up for it, he decided to offer her a very special gift. And what was this gift? This gift, there's a saying in English, is that, can you offer me the moon? Can you give me the moon? Because it's the most inconceivable, unlikely gift you can offer to anyone. But sure enough, there's a company on the planet today that is offering parcels of property of the moon for sale. And so this billionaire decided to put down his hard-earned money to purchase 100 acres of land on the moon. He's got the certificate to show it, and he offered it to his wife for her anniversary. And so it actually says on the certificate, you own from this longitude to this latitude, this square of land on the moon. And so you can pull out your telescope, you can admire it. And I suppose she was happy, but still not satisfied enough. Because what's the use of having this little piece of paper that says you're entitled to the moon? It's just a piece of paper. It's about as useless as all the cash we carry around as dollars or rupees. I mean, what can you do with a piece of paper? You can't eat it. It has no real intrinsic value. You can't really enjoy it. And so in the same way, what's the use of this moon certificate? And so, not to be outdone, this billionaire decided to enlist the help of some of the Soviet Union's ex-space program astronauts, and he decided to commission them to take him on a honeymoon, literally around the moon. And what's the bill on such a honeymoon? You may think, oh, you know, let's go to Tirupati, let's go to Niagara Falls. But this honeymoon put him back $300 million. $150 for halfway around the moon, but you got to come back, so $300 for the full bill, like that. So many romantic couples aspire for the amazing dinners under the moon to enjoy, but he decided to go a step further and enjoy a dinner around the moon. This is the extent to which people have inflated their own false egos to think that I can possess a, you know, stellar body. And this has precedent because our Hiranyakashipu or Ravana, for example, they were also so deluded by this sense of false proprietorship that they ended up conquering the whole universe. So whereas our billionaire can be considered a little thief, we have our Hiranyakashipu who is a big thief and who is actually setting the standard for being a demon. And so the people we see on our planet today are just little pittances. They're little small fries compared to our demons of yore. But this is the insanity that man has subjected himself to. And this is further explained by this notion today of genetically modified organisms, of playing God with nature. There was like a landmark lawsuit that took place in America some decades ago where some scientists, they had a bacteria and they actually were successful in modifying some of the genes, some of the DNA of this bacteria, and they issued a patent to say that because we've altered this biological life form, therefore, we're entitled to the ownership of its DNA. And this was very controversial. In the Supreme Court, they debated back and forth to see if it's actually legitimate to stake a claim over a biological life form. Because there's this tacit understanding that, well, obviously you didn't create it, you didn't, you know, conjure it up from scratch. You took what was pre-existing and you just made some adjustments. But nonetheless, by the power of their political lobby or economic influence, they were successful in winning this landmark case and having proprietorship over a living entity's DNA. And so this was a real slippery slope because it actually ushered in a whole new era of patenting over biological life forms. And it's gotten to the point where there's one company in the world, Monsanto, that has 11,000 patents over a biological organism that it has inserted a new gene inside of. And so to get us some scope for how disastrous this is, they have a strand of corn that is resistant to a particular kind of pest. But the only means by which this corn can grow in the field is if it's watered with a very specific kind of fertilizer. So you just try to plant it in a field, water it, it won't grow. Only in tandem, in conjunction with this fertilizer, can it actually sprout. But the advantage is, once it's sprouted, it's immune to the attack of all kinds of pests. But the interesting scheme of Monsanto is that, on the one hand, they've manufactured the seed for this corn, and on the other, they also manufacture the fertilizer. So they make a double profit. Not only are you dependent on them for the seed, but the fertilizer as well. And as it turns out, one truck was driving down a country road, and this truck was full to the brim with this Monsanto corn seed. And because of the careless truck driver, the tarp that was covering the truck flew off, and all this seed started blowing into all the neighboring fields. And so, one day, one unsuspecting farmer, he went to examine his field, but he noticed that even though he had not watered any of his crops, they were still resistant to pests, and he was very much amazed at this new strain. And he started bragging to all his friends about the quality of his seed, and sooner or later, Monsanto found out, they heard through the grapevine, that there was this one corn farmer who had actually succeeded in what? In actually having a pest-resistant plant. So Monsanto went and did the investigation. They tested the DNA, and they concluded that their strain of corn had crossbred with this farmer's native corn and that he was illicitly using their property. And so Monsanto immediately issued a lawsuit. They sued this farmer for using their corn like that. They say, as a farmer, what right do you have to steal our seed? And so any sane person can see that it's actually the corporation's responsibility to make sure that their seed doesn't mix with his. But in spite of this, the farmer failed in court and had to pay huge sums, royalties, for trying to grow someone else's seed. And the problem, as it extrapolates around the world, is that soon these biotech firms can actually control all the seeds and all the agriculture and all the crops around the world. And anytime any farmer wants to grow something, he's got to pay this company a royalty that nobody can own, you know, their own strand of seed anymore. Is that they've got a monopoly over everything. They control the food supply, more or less. And so this is the direction that our demonic society is headed in a very real way today. There are patents out right now for basmati rice. One company is trying to own basmati. Anybody who wants to use it in the future has to pay them. They're trying to patent the neem tree, trying to patent the breast cancer gene like that. So anybody who wants to purchase this drug, cancer-fighting drug, has to pay a hugely multiplied fee just to use their gene like that. So this is the insanity in which our society has found itself in, and it's all due to this notion of proprietorship, is that man, somehow or other, is entitled to ownership of God's property, of God's creation like this. So if we simply stick to these precepts of educating others about our own lack of proprietorship, then this is the highest philanthropy work Prabhupada says we can perform for the world. So if we want to ask ourselves, what can we do in order to give Krishna pleasure? That is to reunite Krishna's living entities, all his children, back with him. Like the story of the prodigal son, of you had a very wealthy landowner and his son decided to carve his own path in the world and told his father to immediately give him his inheritance, and the son decided to go away and seek his own fortune. And so eventually this bold, enterprising young man divests himself of his family ties and falls into sin in the city. He ends up squandering all his wealth that he inherited, and he ends up as a swine farmer feeding the pigs. And he becomes so poverty-stricken that he has to eat the same food that he feeds to the pigs. And lamenting his position, he remembers his connection with God previously. Sorry, his connection with his father. And he decides to return to his father's house. And then his father embraces him and welcomes him back to the fold. So in the same way, this is our position in the world, is that we've all abandoned the Supreme Father. Krishna says, Tasam brahma mahadyonir aham bija pradapitaha. If we want to talk about seeds and who owns the seed, Krishna is saying, aham bija prada, that I am the one who's giving all these seeds. I am the male who's impregnating this material nature, and all the living entities are coming from me. Krishna is the Supreme Father, so he's entitled. He's the real owner. So in the same way, our job as servants of Srila Prabhupada and the whole Guru Parampara is to render this service to the Lord by reuniting all of his wayward souls back to the kingdom of God like this. And that's why Krishna says, Prabhupada explains that the yogi who has withdrawn to a secluded place in order to meditate perfectly may not be as perfect as a devotee who is trying his best to turn every man toward Krishna consciousness. And how do we turn every man back towards the Lord? It's by reminding him of his position as part and parcel of the Lord, as the child of God. And so it's by imparting this knowledge, by studying these books, by teaching these books, by, through our efforts, our activities, our mind, body, and words, supporting the cause of spreading Krishna consciousness, where we can actually ascend to this highest platform of yoga. It's automatically built in because Krishna will cleanse within our hearts all the anartas that previously we would have had to struggle so hard to do on our own. So the notion of philanthropy has been usurped today by this very altruistic notion of feeding the poor, of having mercy on all the living entities who are suffering. But the problem is, it's like trying to water the leaves or the fruits on the tree. Giving pleasure to the branches and the twigs is not nearly as effective as giving water to the root. So in that sense, we find so many philanthropic efforts today are misguided completely. I was just reading that there is this one animal rights group, and they're seeing the super soul in the pig, in the cow, in the chicken, and they want to give back to their poor, oppressed brother by liberating them from the confines of these slaughterhouses. And so together, they rallied a big troop of protesters outside of this massive pig slaughterhouse. And outside of the barbed wire fence, they were picketing, they had their signs, they were shouting slogans. And all the workers in the slaughterhouse became very disturbed by this commotion. And they were making so much noise with their megaphones that even the pigs themselves were being all roused into this total wild, crazy stampeding. And the pigs got into such a frenzy. And pigs, they're really bulky. They're actually feeding them so many hormones that they're so packed with muscle that these pigs started charging at the fences in their confines. And by the force of this stampede, they managed to knock down the entire barbed wire fence. And they were heading straight at the group of protesters. And the protesters, burdened by all their signs and megaphones, were powerless to move. And they got trampled over by this huge stampede of pigs. And many of them lost their lives under the hoofs of these pigs like that. So we find that even though they're so well-intentioned, sometimes your attempts at philanthropy can really turn on you. In a similar way, there was a story about, you know, the seal kill in Canada. Like, for the fur industry, so many hunters are out there killing innocent seals. They're trying to save these seals from these oil slicks to bring them back to life. And I heard that this one well-wishing group of, you know, animal rights activists managed to nurse like an oil-slicked seal back to health. And they were feeding it, nursing it back to shape, and, you know, really just tending it like a baby for weeks to get it back in shape to be thrown back into the wild. And on the day of its reemergence into the wild, they organized a big press conference, invited all the media. Their little seal friend would again be rejoined with his brothers out in the wild, open ocean. And no sooner was the seal out into the open, and you could tell the seal was so happy, he turned around to wave to his human friends, when a shark, out of the blue, immediately ate the seal with one bite and chomped him away like that. So in spite of all their efforts and endeavors to give back to this one seal, still by the cruel laws of nature, his time had come, and he was immediately clasped in the jaws of death like that. So over and over again, you find these well-wishing philanthropists like, oh, let's save all the sweatshop workers in Nepal, I heard. There's all these, you know, underage girls who are working, sewing garments for all these evil brands and corporations and athletic companies in the West. So they decided to protest against this sweatshop factory, and all the girls were released from bondage. But within a week, as it turns out, they were immediately snatched up into the prostitution industry. That because they had no other alternatives economically than sewing these clothes, still they were immediately preyed upon by unscrupulous men who took them into some other potentially worse activity. So our attempts at benefiting others are being foiled over and over and over again in this world. Our welfare work is actually the product of our own ego. Because Krishna is saying in this verse in the fifth chapter, Suridam Sarva Bhutanam, that, you know what, I'm the friend of all living entities. But in the mode of passion, we're so contaminated with our wealth and our pride and our position and our connections that actually I, the philanthropist, am really the friend of all living entities. And therefore, I will give in charity. I will perform philanthropic work. And when these kind of activities are divorced from Krishna, they're actually have zero connection with the Supreme Lord, with the actual friend, then they can't possibly bear any benefit for the living entities. It's flawed right from the beginning by virtue of one's mistaken misidentity to think that I am the enjoyer, I will enjoy all the recognition of being a great donor and philanthropist. This is the problem with trying to perform any good work in this world separate from Krishna. So, in order to conclude, what we're emphasizing is that, first of all, the necessity of controlling one's senses. Bhagavad Gita, the first six chapters are more or less about how to control the mind, control the senses, in order to be an able recipient for knowledge, to become more aware of the Supersoul, eventually to recognize that the Supersoul is Krishna, and then, at the end, by following this practice, to render devotional service unto Krishna. Once you recognize he's there in your heart, you say, hey, let's come out of my secluded place and do some service. My point, or Prabhupada's point in today's verse, is that rather than wait, perform this long process, and then realize that Krishna is God, Krishna is the enjoyer, Krishna is the proprietor, you start at the beginning. You accept right now, today, this instant, that Krishna is the supreme friend, that the supreme perfection in life comes from surrendering to the Lord today. And one takes the shortcut. For such an intelligent person, the end is the same as the means. They're identical. For the Ashtanga yogi, his means are different than his end. So Prabhupada is imploring us to have the knowledge to just submit right off the bat, to surrender to the words of Sri Krishna, and to engage in this service right from the get-go. And this is the sum and substance of Bhagavad Gita that's coming out in this verse today. So we'll all pray that we can develop this vision of rendering service to all the devotees out of love, and in this way come to that eventual platform of pure, unalloyed service and love to the Lord. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions today or comments? Corrections. Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagavan ki jai. Nitai Gaur Premanande. Hari Hari Bol.